Hello, and welcome to the history of Haiti.
So last episode, President of Haiti, Philippe Guerriere, managed to avoid the fate of sooner or later being overthrown by dying. In this episode, his successor, Jean-Louis Pirot, will prove himself to be not nearly as politically agile as his predecessor, leading to another one-year president. One of the most important concepts that is linked to President Guerriere, as well as to varying extents, Pirot, Richer, and Solanke, is that of politique des doubleurs. According to Google Translate, this translates in French to understudy policy. This term refers to when the colored elites choose a black man, usually with some kind of national name recognition, as president, believing that they can control him and that they will have the real power. This is obviously the case with Guerriere, but it is not so much the case with Pirot. Pirot had been chosen by the Council of State, but he would have a much larger hand in national policy than Guerriere. So after the death of Guerriere, Pirot was chosen as president. It should be noted that both the Council of Secretaries of State and the Council of State both still remained. However, like his predecessor, Pirot would rule under no constitution. He was in Le Cap at the time, and so he made his way south to Port-au-Prince. Along the way, though, he stopped at the city of Saint-Marc to be sworn in as president. And thus, he became president at the same place where he will lose his presidency, not to get ahead of myself. Once he arrived in Port-au-Prince, Pirot was able to get a head start on the road to being overthrown. Almost immediately after arriving, Pirot decided to return to his home of Le Cap. Pirot was a northerner, an old partisan of Christophe. He had little trust for Port-au-Prince, and he feared the political action that had been running through the city since the election of 1842. However, the other governing bodies, the Council of Secretaries of State and the Council of State, both remained in Port-au-Prince, at least for now. This kind of separated Pirot from the central political action and probably did not inspire confidence in himself from the people of the South and West departments. Another blunder Pirot would soon fall into was trying to invade the East again. Whereas Guerriere had just let Santo Domingo go, Pirot was intent on reestablishing Haitian supremacy over the whole island. He published an act asking for Dominicans to reunite with Haiti, an act which angered the Dominicans. Upon hearing of his act, the Dominicans sent soldiers to the Haitian-Dominican border, bringing the number of Dominicans on that border up to 1,500. Okay, so that part about them bringing soldiers to the border is a bit of a lie, because at this point, the border was completely undefined. The old Franco-Spanish border was long gone. There was, of course, overlap between the Haitians and Dominicans, making it super unclear where to draw the line. But along this general borderlands area, fighting continued between the Haitians and Dominicans. Bolstered by their reinforcements, in June 1845, the Dominicans launched an offensive, capturing several important towns and pushing the Haitian army back to the old French border. Soon, however, Pirot was able to reinforce his own army on the border with more Haitians. These Haitians turned around and retook the cities captured by the Dominicans. The Dominicans were heavily disorganized and unprepared for a real war. When they were attacked, the Dominicans chose to burn and pillage the towns they were occupying before fleeing them. Even after this, however, the fighting along the eastern border continued with Dominican guerrillas joining the Dominican army in their resistance. Guerriere had been relatively popular during his rule, and thus the only real challenge to his authority he had faced came from old partisans of Gerard. In the aftermath of their failed revolt, many of them were arrested. some were executed, while many others were rightfully acquitted. However, even after the sweeping crackdown on their conspiracy, many Girard loyalists still remained. In the city of Port-au-Prince, these Girard loyalists gathered together and began forming yet another conspiracy. As always seems to happen with these conspiracies, the authorities knew it existed, but didn't take the right steps they could have to prevent its outbreak. In fact, the Council of Secretaries of State knew about it, but they chose to postpone action until after the conspirators had chosen to attack. This attack happened on the night of September 17th, when 60 conspirators met in Port-au-Prince and then proceeded to try to raise the city in revolt. When this failed, because of course it did, we're only halfway through the episode, the conspirators decided to try again in another city. So they fled Port-au-Prince and arrived in Laogon. There, Girard was less unpopular, which allowed them to raise another 140 men to their banner, bringing their total number up to 200 guys. Now that the revolt had broken out, the Port-au-Prince government actually decided to start their crackdown. The West Department was declared under a state of siege, and in Port-au-Prince, an army 700 strong was marshaled and sent to crush the revolt in Laogon. This army did so. They arrived in Laogon, and after a day of fierce fighting in the streets, the rebels had all been captured or scattered into the nearby woods. Then, without orders, the person in charge of the army had almost all the prisoners shot without trial, which is, you know, a war crime. This is not something that usually happens with these kinds of revolts. Pierrot was horrified at the news of this. While Pierrot did not condone this, this is a good example of some of the new leaders turning out to be far more bloodthirsty than Boyer had ever been, doing things such as Girard's sack of Azua. Here, I want to take a brief tangent from the politics to talk about a relatively unimportant, but nevertheless interesting story from this time. So, in the countryside, voodoo was very common. During Pierrot's rule, there were two briefly lived voodoo cults that emerged and then disappeared. They were organized into traveling bands who went around stealing and killing. They carried objects such as bones, idols, and killing sticks. To everyone, they were known as cannibals, and many suspected that they were werewolves or beings of pure evil. Eventually, the governments arrested a bunch of these guys, but then let them go. They feared foreigners discovering these guys' cannibalism. To celebrate, these cults had a religious festival in front of the prison, which included ritual dancing, animal worship, and which ended with a kind of ritual human sacrifice. After this, the two cults disappeared as mysteriously as they had come about. Another brief tangent from the rule of Pierrot is that here is where we really start to see the complete rehabilitation of Jean-Jacques Dessalines. If you will remember, Dessalines was a genocidal tyrant who re-enslaved the Black Haitians and was absolutely hated by everyone at the time. But that was 40 years ago. The new, rising generation of Haitian leaders and politicians was heavily composed of people who had not lived through the revolution. They could not remember the atrocities and war crimes of Dessalines. All they knew was a hero who'd won freedom for Haiti. I also suspect, although this is just speculation on my part, that Dessalines took on a bit of a racial tone, being after all a black who had massacred whites. Because of this, Pierrot decided to order funeral services for Dessalines, who had died 4 decades ago, to be hosted in cities across the Republic. Here is where Dessalines transforms from being the man Dessalines into the myth of Dessalines. Being a northerner in all, Pierrot could still remember the glory days of Le Cap that it had once had. He was old enough to have been 9 years old when the French administration had moved the capital from Le Cap to Port-au-Prince. He remembered when Le Cap had once been the capital of Christophe's kingdom. This probably fed heavily into his decision to move the capital of Haiti from Port-au-Prince to Le Cap. He also distrusted the citizens of Port-au-Prince and believed that the whole of the West Department was hostile to him. It should also be noted that many people believed him to be hostile towards the coloreds. He had the Council of Secretaries of State, as well as the Council of State, both relocate to Le Cap. This turned out to be a serious political mistake, which separated him from the home of political action in Haiti. During the crushed Léogâne Revolt, many soldiers from the Haitian-Dominican border had been diverted back to the west. In addition, many had also deserted, believing that the revolt had succeeded. This ended up with the border being pretty much abandoned by Haitians. Some soldiers are reported as saying that if the Dominicans had a Cortes or a Pizarro, Port-au-Prince would be occupied. Due to this, about 1,000 Dominicans attacked a Haitian fort and then slaughtered its 300-man garrison when they captured it. This attack enraged Pierrot, who clearly wanted an invasion of Santo Domingo. This he was preparing for, and everyone knew this is what Pierrot was going to do. But an invasion of the East was incredibly unpopular. Taking advantage of this, a guy named Riche, who had been plotting a conspiracy to overthrow Pierrot for a while now, was able to further grow his conspiracy. Riche was an old Christophe loyalist who had been a high-ranking soldier in his government. He is most notable for having played a large role in Christophe's small genocide against the coloreds. So, yeah, he's a weird guy for the colored elites to be championing against Pierrot. But anyway, one of the most important things Pierrot did, which we will see the effects of next episode, was to appoint Aku, remember him, to command a district in the south. When Pierrot became president, Aku had been released, but noticing his hatred of Herard, Pierrot decided to appoint Aku to command one of the districts in the south. This fed his loss of allies. The colored elite feared the appointment of Aku and also believed Pierrot to be anti-colored, probably because of his affiliation with Christophe. He had also proven himself to be not as good of a puppet as Guerriere had been. In addition, the commoners did not approve of his plan to invade Santo Domingo. Mainly in the cities of Port-au-Prince and Saint-Marc, there was a lot of agitation around Pierrot and his invasion of Santo Domingo. And as always, the army was not particularly loyal to the established regime. With this, a conspiracy in Saint-Marc started up with the plan to make Riche president. So on February 27th, the conspiracy for the appointment of Riche to president broke out in the city of Saint-Marc. There, the conspirators were able to easily convince the garrison to revolt against Pierrot. They proclaimed Riche president and created a new commission for it. 1,200 of these guys signed a letter proclaiming Riche president, which was sent to Port-au-Prince. That city, too, joined the bloodless revolt against Pierrot. There, Riche himself accepted the presidency and proclaimed a modified version of the Constitution of 1816 to be in effect once again. Across Haiti, armies and districts joined the revolt for Riche. Pierrot tried to hold firm and hold on to power, but he was soon able to see the writing on the wall and chose to resign. However, unlike Herard or Boyer, Pierrot was allowed to stay in Haiti, where he would soon once again become a high-ranking government official. So far, this series of one-year presidents have all met pretty decent endings. Boyer spent the rest of his life in Paris. Herard was able to flee to Jamaica. Guerriere died of natural causes while in office. And Pierrot was able to stay in Haiti. But Riche will not meet such a tranquil fate. Like Guerriere, he will die in office. Although, unlike Guerriere, he will not die of natural causes. Maybe. talk about that next episode.